There is a character in the Bible, the New Testament, who is referred to as the son of consolation or the son of encouragement. Barnabas, of course, we know him. I think his name was Joses, and they called him Barnabas. But I want to talk a little about Barnabas' effect very quickly to set a tone for the fact that he was an encouragement to important people in the Bible. And so he played a very, very vital role, even though his role may have been considered on a lower level or at least less exposure to him than there was to those he encouraged. But he did encourage people in many ways. In Acts, the 4th chapter, and verse 36, it says, "And Joseph, who by the apostles was surnamed Barnabas, which is being interpreted son of exhortation, a Levite, a man of Cyprus by race, having a field, sold it and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet." Now, in this particular instance, he was obviously encouraging in a benevolent sense. There were people who had continued to reside in Jerusalem as a result of their conversion after the day of Pentecost, and some had stayed beyond their means and were facing difficult times. And the brethren began to gather money, and one of the things that this man did was sell a piece of property so he could contribute to that cause. He was an encouragement, certainly, in that situation. We find later in the 9th chapter of the book of Acts, when Saul of Tarsus is converted, as we recognize as we study the story of Saul's conversion, that there were many Christians who were leery of him, fearful of him, in fact. Ananias was even fearful of going to teach him the truth, but trusted in the advice of God and went and did so. When Saul then was converted, he began to preach the gospel, and Barnabas was the one who stood beside him, if you will, and encouraged him and helped him to overcome the opposition that he received when he went to Jerusalem, because he wanted to join himself to the Christians in Jerusalem, but they were, like most, they knew his reputation and they were fearful of him. Barnabas served, if you will, as a go-between, as an encourager, if you will, to both Saul and to the brethren on that occasion. A couple of chapters later, in the 11th chapter, about verses 22 and following, Barnabas is chosen by the brethren in Jerusalem to go encourage the brethren in Antioch. The Gentiles in Antioch who had obeyed the gospel needed someone with more experience, if you will, and they needed someone to come along who could help them on their way. He served as the man to do that. So you can see that he was developing a reputation as one who would strengthen a given situation, who would encourage someone to be better and more faithful, and so forth. Well, there comes a time then when his time with the Apostle Paul, because of his cousin John Mark, who went with them on the first trip they took, but did not stay for the duration of the trip, and returned home. And when they were ready to leave the Jerusalem conference then, in Acts the 15th chapter, and travel again, Barnabas had planned to take John Mark with them again. And Paul was upset over that. There came a division, if you will, between them, over that issue. John Mark was Barnabas' cousin. And so naturally he wanted to see that he was not damaged in the process. And so Paul took Silas with him, as you'll recall. And they traveled together from that point on. And Barnabas took his cousin John Mark with him. And they went to Cyprus and encouraged the saints over there. Again, if you look over at 2 Timothy, the 4th chapter, in about verse 11, many years later, we find that the Apostle Paul in prison says, "Send John Mark to see me. He is useful to me." You see, Barnabas was successful in in encouraging Mark so that he continued to be faithful, Paul was wise enough to see that he was faithful and was useful in service. And so the effect of Barnabas' encouragement continued to help people become stronger, to become more faithful. And so I think what we need to understand from this example is that encouragement is always needed. We need encouragement. If ever there was a time when people needed encouragement to be faithful to God, it is now. Now, we naturally live now. We think this is the worst time mankind has ever faced. I'm not sure it is. I'm not that good a historian to know for sure, but I know during many times in history, men became very decadent in their lifestyles and in the influence they had on others around them. But we're certainly seeing that in our world and in our own nation. And so when we do and we see those things chip away at the very foundational principles that God has established for us in our lives of service to Him while we're here, then I think it's time that we get some encouragement. You know, in our day and time, spouses need to be encouraged to be faithful both to God and to each other. That's a needed thing in our day and time. I know that I wish I could find better words to say these things, but so many times, those of us who are older talk to the younger people about all the things you're going to face, and you probably get tired of us saying, oh, you're facing such a tough time and we want to help you along, but we do want to encourage you. You're facing things in your days that we did not. We face things in our days that our parents did not. And so on it goes. It doesn't mean that it's any more difficult for one than another, but it does mean this, that there's a devil, Satan himself, in this world that is working against us. And we've talked in past lessons about him and his attempt to influence us and to lead us astray. And so, young married couples, old married couples, in between married couples, have things that draw them, or can at least draw them, apart from one another. And even more importantly, things that can pull them away from God. It is my contention, and I'll make that point repeatedly in the lesson tonight, it is my contention that the first step in a husband or a wife pulling away from one another is that they pulled away from God to begin with. Because I believe if we are harmonious in our relationship with God, that we will continue to value and respect the institution of marriage that He's established. Malachi, in the second chapter of Malachi in verse 16, talks about the fact that God hates divorce. He hates for men to divorce. And he was saying that because there was a time when men were taking advantage of women and marrying them and then putting them away. And oftentimes when they would put them away, they were even inconsiderate about caring for them, the responsibility they had to care for them. Jesus in Matthew the 19th chapter, verses 3 through 9, when he is asked questions about divorce that occurred in the Old Testament, under the law of Moses, in fact, a reference to chapter 24 of Deuteronomy, the first few verses of that chapter, the question pertains to that. And Jesus actually rises above the law of Moses and says this, from the beginning it was not so. Moses allowed you to do that, he said, for the hardness of your heart. But from the beginning it was not so. God set it up so that it would be one man, one woman for life. A man would leave his father and mother, a woman would leave her father and mother, and they would cleave to one another until death do they part. That's the picture Jesus portrayed. And the point we need to make to ourselves is that we want to encourage one another in that regard. We want everyone to know that we value our marriages, that we are loyal to our spouses. First of all, because we love God, and second of all, because we love them. There's another family tradition that seems to be disrespected in our society, or at least abused, should I say. When Paul tells of the Ephesians in the 6th chapter of Ephesians in verse 4, that fathers are to train their children up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. They're not to serve as a provocation to them. They're not to provoke them to wrath, but they are to bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. And so we look at a society today, and this is not, I'm not trying to pick on anyone or anything, but I'm trying to point out that these are the danger signs for us. We look at a society today where men are oftentimes demanded many hours of work and service to the employer that they are employed by. And so what is the net effect of that if that continues day in, day out, month in, month out, year in, year out? Pretty soon there's a pattern established and the father becomes a tad absent in the bringing up of the children, in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. It's a very, very important role in our society. Society cries today about fatherless children, about the high rate of crime and poor education among children that do not have fathers. That doesn't surprise us, does it? It doesn't surprise us at all that that is the case. But what we want to do with ourselves, starting with us, inside the walls, if you will, of this building, we want to be sure that we bring our children up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. I've said this before. I say it to no one's disparagement and to no one's sensitive feelings or trying to hurt anyone at all. But this congregation at Lenexa would need a building twice this size if from the time that I have lived here at least, if from the time that I have lived here, and it was here before I got here, if the members' children were faithful to this day and worshiping. Surely some of them would have stayed in our fair city. If not, then we would have lost them that way, which would not have been a severe loss. But I say that not because Lenexa should be, have a mark on it. I say it because that's the way our society has trended and we have been affected by it. We have been affected by it and we will continue to be until we can, as a group, all of us participate in the encouragement that fathers need in bringing up their children in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. I made the point that our love for God is the stabilizing factor in all of these things we shall talk about. In Matthew the 10th chapter, beginning in verse 34, Jesus makes a very, very harsh sounding statement, which is an attempt to depict to people the effect of his teaching and that the gospel will have on society. Think not, he said, that I came to send peace on the earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. For I came to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's foes shall be they of his own household. He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he that doth not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He that findeth his life shall lose it, and he that loseth his life for my sake shall find it. Jesus says that if we love God first, and we recognize the commitment we have made when we obey the gospel, and we have received the remission of our sins, then we have become a disciple of the Lord. The passage in Ephesians, the 4th chapter, lists all the things, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, so forth. But it says one Lord. Do we read that, recognize the meaning of the term Lord? There's one Lord. There's one who is the Lord over us. There's one who tells us what to do. There is one we serve. Our King, if you will, that we serve. And so, fathers who are trying to bring up their children, spouses who are trying to set an example for others and are trying to sustain a loving relationship before God, need to love God first. And when they are committed to God first, then these other things are naturally following, because we're listening to our Lord. We're listening to His instruction, and His instruction is for us to bring up our children in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. So what do? We automatically plan to achieve what God would ask us to do. Mothers are called upon to have a nurturing effect in the family. They nurture their children. Now, we talk about fathers bringing them up in the nurture of the Lord, but children are also nurtured by their mother. That is, the mother has that effect on the family in that she creates a healthy atmosphere for children to grow and to gain confidence and to do the things that they should do. And this is a vital role for women who are servants of the Lord. In 1 Timothy, the 5th chapter, and verse 14, when Paul is addressing somewhat of an issue with unmarried women, he says in verse 13, "And withal they learn to be idle, going about from house to house, and not only idle, but tattlers also and busybodies, speaking things which they ought not." In other words, women, he says, single women here in this society in which they lived are idle, and they become busybodies and tattletales and so forth. So he says in verse 14, "I desire therefore that the younger widows marry, bear children, rule the household, give no occasion to the adversary for reviling." And so he indicates that the role he would like to see for women is to be that focal point of the family. You know, he uses a term there that's pretty interesting. When he says, he takes this contrast and he pictures these young women who are busybodies of time on their hands. He says, "I want to transfer them to women who have families, and I want them to rule the household." Now, that phrase in that text that says rule the household means literally to be in charge of the household. There's no doubt, we don't make any hesitation about this, that Ephesians 5th chapter and other passages as well teach us that the husband is the head of the wife. We're not trying to deny that, but we're trying to explain to you that there's a role that a wife and a mother has. She rules the household. That's her domain. Don't go into her kitchen and tell her where to put the ice cream scooper. Even though sometimes somebody misplaces mine, I try to be gentle when I'm looking for it, because that's her domain, you see. That's what she rules. She rules the house. She wants the couch facing the east, I'm there to move it. Okay? Whatever she determines is the best atmosphere for that household, as long as it meets with God's approval, we're there to comply, you see. She rules the household. That's what she's for. The husband doesn't have the capability. He's not manufactured or created to be that person that she is. In Titus, the 2nd chapter, verses 3-5, Titus is pleading here, and understand that in this text, it's interesting that he uses the word sound doctrine several times. So Titus is telling, or Paul is telling Titus that I want you to preach sound doctrine, and this is sound doctrine. Verse 3, that aged women, likewise be reverent in demeanor, not slanderers, nor enslaved to much wine, teachers of that which is good, that they may train the young women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be sober-minded, chaste, workers at home, kind, being in subjection to their own husbands, that the word of God be not blasphemed. And so you see this ruler of the household that we talked about in 1 Timothy that sets the tone for this family in so many ways. I know that when our children were small, I didn't always have the ability to reason with a 4-year-old. It just wasn't kind of a thing that I was really, really good at. And many times, the mother of those children communicated to them the family message, if you will. That's her domain. That's what she does. She does it well. And we need to see that we honor that principle that God has set forth, and that we encourage our young people to conduct and plan their lives according to God's plan, you see, for the home. We have, I think, a reasonably high percentage of elderly Christians in our number. I think that we have, I know of 5 members that we have here that are in excess of 90 years old. They've already achieved something I have no hope of ever accomplishing, but nevertheless, they face obstacles. Age brings obstacles. I can't play center field anymore. That's disappointing. But I don't have any trouble cutting my grass or doing the chores around my house or getting to services and doing things for others as they need them. But when you're 91 years old or you're 95 years old or whatever age you are, there are obstacles that you face that others do not. And it's important for us to encourage those people. It really is. We need them to know how much it means to us when they are successful at being able to come out. We need to take our time and visit them, communicate with them, so that they, even when they're unable to worship with the saints, they're still encouraged in their private lives to give themselves over to prayer, meditation, the Word of God, to remain strong. There is no great honor in clinging to life on this earth. And there will be some, as they reach a certain age in life, that will be ready to go. We tell the story among ourselves of Grant Clothier. And Grant went to the doctor several years ago, actually. Grant's 91 now, and he went to the doctor several years ago, and the doctor told him, he said, "We're going to have to put in a pacemaker." He says, "If we don't put in a pacemaker, you're probably going to have a heart attack and die." And Grant says, "What's the bad news?" Because he kept saying he was ready to go. Well, Pat got tired of hearing that. And so she kind of quieted that down in him now. He doesn't say that out loud anymore. He just keeps his thoughts to himself. But there comes a time when you're ready to go. Paul said in Philippians, the 1st chapter, that he was ready to go. Now, Paul wasn't 91 years old, even close to it. People didn't probably live that long in his day and time, and particularly people that went around getting shipwrecked and beaten severely and abused as he did, 2 Corinthians 11, if you want to read a list of those things. But in Philippians, the 1st chapter, his expression was this way, beginning in verse 21. He said, "For to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. But if to live in the flesh, if this shall bring fruit from my work, then what shall I choose, or what I shall choose, I know not. But I am in a strait betwixt the two, having the desire to depart and be with Christ, for it is very far better. Yet to abide in the flesh is more needful for your sake. I'll stay. I'll stay and endure this prison cell and maybe the abuse that I'll receive here and some that I'll receive after I get out of here. But you need to recognize that as I stand in life, as my life stands with what I have before me on this earth, Paul says, it's better for me to go. Selfishly, I'd be better off to go, you see. Well, in 2 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, and beginning with the very first verse of that chapter, Paul describes here, down through about verse 8, he describes this situation that we live in this earthly tabernacle, which is certainly less than perfect. And so then he says, what we really desire is when we can be clothed upon with our heavenly or eternal tabernacle. And so he says, we really prefer to be present with the Lord in absent this earthly tabernacle. But of course, as in all other cases, we wait and we serve the Lord's wishes, whatever it may be. My point being that people may or may not reach a point where this life, they've had all of it they want. There's nothing wrong with that feeling. But it is important that for the rest of us to encourage them so that they will be faithful until the day that God calls them away. Well, as a congregation, as individuals, let us ask ourselves really what our legacy will be. What will we be as a group looked upon as? And what will I be as an individual viewed upon as I try to sustain these things? As I try to be someone who encourages others, and as I try to live the kind of life others encourage me to live, and as we interact with one another that way, you see, what happens is we begin then to strengthen the bonds that exist right here now. And we become stronger as individuals, but we become stronger related to one another. And as a result, as a unit, we become stronger and more effective. And our reach into this community, our influence on the people in the neighborhoods around us will be better and better as our personal strength increases and as our group strength will naturally increase with that personal strength. So what will our legacy be? In Matthew, the 12th chapter, in verse 30, Jesus is trying to point out how these people need to recognize Satan. And they need to realize that Satan is not someone that you can have a modest relationship with, that you can dabble with in any kind. And so in verse 30 he says, he that is not with me is against me, and he that gathereth not with me scattereth. Jesus says, there's no in-between. You're either for me or you're against me. And our legacy needs to be that of people, individuals, each of us, and as a congregation that stand for all of the things that God stands for, that Christ has taught us. And wholesome marriages, wholesome families that are led by fathers, nurtured by mothers, elderly people who may not be able to jump in their automobile and go do things that you can do, but they can, in other ways, be an encouragement to you. When you see them, when you see it take them every ounce of strength they have to serve the Lord, and yet they do it. then they can be a great example as well. And so our legacy then becomes, both as individuals and as a group, one where people recognize we serve the Lord. And all the other things that we do in this life are in addition to that or outside that parameter or in excess of that, but we'll all be guided by and in harmony with that message that God has sent to us. And we must encourage each other to do that. I hope that we can all become kind of a Barnabas, if you will, and take people, each other, under our wing as needed. As we see someone who struggles with something, let us step in and help in any way that we can. As we see someone who is maybe even suffering spiritually because of great difficulties, material or temporally, let us be sure to keep our eyes peeled, recognize those things, and we can do everything that we can to relieve their suffering. That's what Barnabas did. Barnabas saw what a person's need was, and he supplied it. Paul needed a friend when he went to Jerusalem to introduce him and to speak for his reputation, which had changed. The people in Jerusalem needed help financially. He sold property to give it to them. The people in Antioch were newborn Christians. They needed someone with more experience to encourage them. And John Mark was possibly at a low point in his life, being rejected by the Apostle Paul himself, and he encouraged him and kept him faithful to the Lord. There may be those here who need to obey the gospel. There may be some who need to be restored to the Lord. Whatever your situation may be, we would encourage you to come as we stand to sing the song that's been selected.